Hi, everyone. You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart. I'm Nancy Giles, filling in for Allison today. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. A quick note before we begin our first segment. This discussion will deal with suicide and might be triggering or difficult for some to hear. If at any time you feel you need help, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. They're open 24 hours a day. Again, that number is 1-800-273-8255. 1 year ago, celebrity chef, author, and travel show host Anthony Bourdain died by suicide in his hotel room in France. He left behind a young daughter, countless friends and family, and millions of fans around the world. And due to his unique openness to just about any media outlet, Bourdain also left behind hundreds of filmed and recorded interviews. And in each and every one, Bourdain is funny, whip-smart, earnest, and above all, candid. All the characteristics that drew so many people to his show and to his best-selling memoirs. A selection of these interviews have been put together in a collection titled Anthony Bourdain, The Last Interview and Other Conversations. In the introduction, written by New Yorker food writer and friend of Bourdain's, Helen Rosner, Rosner notes how remarkable it is that throughout all the fame, adoration, and accolades, the interviews in this book reveal that Tony always remained Tony. Helen Rosner joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
He is such a remarkable dude, you know?
He really is.
How did you guys meet? How did you and Bourdain meet?
Well, you know, as you said, I'm a food writer, and he was, among other things, a food writer, too. Our orbits crossed in 1,000 little ways before we actually met for real. In fact, the first sort of overture of friendship was that he DM'd me on Twitter one day to say that he really liked something that I'd written.
That must have been so exciting.
It was a pretty cool moment, and our friendship kind of grew from there.
How would you describe that friendship? I mean, obviously food brought you together, but what kind of friend was he?
Well, you know, I think that I wouldn't describe myself as, you know, one of his closest friends. I certainly wasn't in the inner circle. But he was a person who I think, and it's evident through his public-facing work so clearly, who took just incredible pleasure in connecting with people and in connecting with humanity. And, you know, what he and I tended to talk about was, you know, food media gossip and you know, we were sort of snarky and jokey together, but we also, I think, shared a really serious sense of responsibility and passion. And this sounds very high-minded, but for the world of food, we wanted to make sure that things were represented properly, that the compassion that's inherent in the world of food, and by the world of food, I mean all of us, you know, like you eat lunch, you're part of the world of food. The compassion and the humanity and the realism of that wasn't lost in favor of sort of quick hit food porn or feelings of just immediate gratification that, you know, he was frequently, and he talks about this often in the interviews that make up this book, he was frequently criticized. If there was ever a thing he was criticized for, it was for being, in scare quotes, too political. And what he often talked about extraordinarily eloquently was that there is nothing more political than food, and that trying to insulate food from a notion of politics or a notion of intersection with our real lives and the forces that shape that is denying humanity, in a sense.
I love that phrase, the world of food, because I'm beginning to connect the dots just hearing you talk. And I'm wondering, was it that world of food and his connection to broadening what people would perceive about food? Was that one of the things that you wanted to capture about your friend in this collection? You were asked to write the introduction.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think you've really hit the nail on the head that he was, by pretty much every measure, the most famous culinary celebrity that we had. There are a lot of famous people who are cooks and writers, but he was miles beyond in terms of his celebrity and his global recognition. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, I feel like he sort of walked through the world with a level of fame that we normally only see with people like heads of state or like Madonna. I mean, like everybody knew who Anthony Bourdain was. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And unlike, you know, most people at that level of recognition, everybody loved him. He was adored, and he wasn't adored in a sort of passionate, you know, dehumanizing, you're an idol on a pedestal kind of way.
Right.
He was adored like a real friend. And I think it was really extraordinary the way that he managed to synthesize his background as a cook and his entree into the world of celebrity as a person writing about food and cooking in restaurants with his general interest in the act of being human.
Well, and speaking of that act of being human, one of the things that's so amazing about him was he was so open about so many things. You know, some people at a certain level of celebrity, they kind of shut down. Not Anthony Bourdain. Why do you think that was? And what do you think the level of his openness to media and to everybody reveals about him?
You know, he became famous when he was in his late 40s. He wrote Kitchen Confidential in the late 90s. It was published in 2000. At that point, if you looked at the arc of his career, you would have said he was at the end of it. You know, he'd spent 20 plus years working in kitchens. He was an older guy, mm-hmm. you know, especially by restaurant standards. He was basically a dinosaur. And he wrote that book looking back on his career. And I don't think he expected, and certainly I can't imagine his publishers expected, so I hope everybody was happily surprised.
This is going to start a new thing.
Right, that yeah. in fact, it was the beginning. It wasn't a retrospective. It was a launch pad. And so that gave him, I think, a degree of perspective, nonchalance. He didn't go into it to become famous. He just became famous as a byproduct of being a person who observed and reported on the state of being a person in the world with humor and clarity and extraordinary writerly skill. But, you know, you tend to see this, right? I think with celebrities who hit their fame later in life, there's a degree of centeredness, there's a degree of honesty, a degree of the self that was able to develop before the self needed to be packaged for public consumption.
Right, and that kind of calms down whatever strange celebrity flameouts that seem to happen with people who are younger.
Sure.
Where that happens. I'm speaking with New Yorker staff writer Helen Rosner about this new collection, Anthony Bourdain, the last interview that she introduced. I'm wondering, do you think that Bourdain felt, because of his fame and because people listened to him when he spoke, you think he felt a sense of responsibility to kind of advocate for causes he believed in?
I'm going to say yes, but I'm also going to say that he would say no. And this was a
Why
topic.
Is that?
Well, this is a thing that he and I talked about often, and it's something that he and I talked about in interviews that were published, as well as just sort of between us. I always was curious and fascinated by the fact that he was very resistant to labeling himself a journalist, and he was also very resistant to labeling any of the work that he did activism. And I think some of that was out of respect for sort of professional activists and full-time activists who are sort of on the ground doing a different style of very direct work. But I do think that if you look at what he's done, his writing, his television shows, his public persona, and you look at the impact that it has had, it's impossible to say that it didn't have an effect.
Right.
And in fact, I think its effect has been monumental. I can't now remember who said it, but, you know, somebody very correct said, you know, Anthony Bourdain has basically had more of an impact on Americans' perception of other nations than any news show, any foreign policy brief. I mean, he was the diplomat between the rest of the world and America. And I don't know if he set out to do that, but it's who he became. And he presented the rest of the world to America, and at the same time also America to itself, with compassion and rigor and that sort of potent combination of anger and love that leads to a really powerful kind of honesty.
Oh, that's so well said. And, you know, it's funny because he had said that he wasn't a spokesperson or advocate for anything. This is an interview with Trevor Noah. He's just genuinely enthusiastic and wants to share that enthusiasm with the world. But in a way, his enthusiasm for the world and his openness about going other places and tasting exotic foods, that is kind of taking a stand, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, and I think in the same way that he was so passionately argumentative towards the fact that there's no such thing as food without politics, I don't think it's possible to walk down the street without politics. And I think that he embodies the fact that any action is taken from a place of who you are as an individual, and who you are as an individual is affected by a million forces, and you affect a million forces. And when somebody has a platform as great as his, and you use it to tell people about the things that he used it to tell people about, it inevitably was going to have something that we could view as political, that we could view as activist, that we could view as, you know, putting a finger on the lever of the world.
It's true. Just the acceptance of other things, you know? When you read through all the interviews, is there anything that stands out to you as a big change that went through Anthony from when they began to, you know, when he, in the end, when he died, and things that also stayed the same? What would you say?
Oh, it's, I love that question. I think that one of the reasons I loved being asked to be part of this book is because this series, and, you know, so there are a lot of books in this series, The Last Interview that Melville House does, with a lot of extraordinary public figures. One of the reasons I love this series is that you see the arc of a celebrity from the beginning to the end of their public life in a way that I think we very rarely get to do, especially in their own words. And in the beginning, you know, the first interview in this book, which is from 2003, a couple of years after Kitchen Confidential came out, when he was famous, he had a TV show, but he wasn't quite the supernova that he became by the end of his career. He's still in a state of wonder, right? You know, he's like, I can't believe that this happened. Overnight, my life changed. And by the end, by the final couple of interviews in this book, you know, he's on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. He's clearly relaxed into this idea of, I belong in this chair. And I don't think that his philosophy or his intellect necessarily evolved in a dramatic way. I think he was already a pretty fully formed person. But his sense of comfort with who he was and his sense that what he had to say was important, was valid, and also that it wasn't necessarily universal, that he was one voice of many, is really evident over the arc of this. And then at the same time, you know, the core Anthony Bourdain, the core Tony, remained the same. I think he had a pretty good North Star from the beginning.
Go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was going to say, you know, he does mention in his final interview in this book, the last interview that he gave before his really tragic suicide, which is a conversation with Eric Cohn at IndieWire, that he was surprised to see that he evolved, particularly in feminism, at the end of his career.
Right. And he would never say exactly whether he was or wasn't, except he did, finally.
He did.
About feminism.
He did. You know, right after he died, I wrote a memory of him for The New Yorker, and one of the anecdotes that I mentioned there was running into him at a party the last time I saw him before he died, when he came up to me, and in a previous interview I'd asked him point blank if he considered himself a feminist, and this was connected to his then girlfriend Asia Argento being, you know, a key figure in the Me Too movement and an accuser of Harvey Weinstein, and he was a big vocal supporter of her. And when I'd asked him if he considered himself a feminist before all of this happened, he demurred and he said, you know, like, I support everything feminism stands for, but I'm uncomfortable with the word. And he came up to me and he said, I am a feminist. Sorry, I can't say that on the radio, but that's what he said. And it's evident in this final interview, he talks about the fact that he didn't realize how much the food world...
This is Helen Rosner speaking from The New Yorker. She's a staff writer, and about the Anthony Bourdain last interview. And I'm Nancy Giles, subbing for Allison Stewart. Sorry about that little curse word that slipped through. Please keep going, Helen.
I'm so sorry. And he says that, you know, his eyes were sort of open to the fact that he always kind of knew intellectually that the food world was not a friendly place for women, that the restaurant world was not a friendly place to women, but that very late in his career, in this final interview, he talks about how his eyes were open to the fact that women were experiencing unpleasant things in their restaurant careers, and they weren't talking to him about it. And that made him realize that he was part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution. Even if he wasn't actively doing things, he realized that you have to be a person who those who are being harmed feel comfortable bringing their harm to.
True.
Which was, I think, a really dramatic evolution for him.
For people, and there are still a few people that might not know Parts Unknown, it was such a widely heralded show. What exactly made that show so special?
Wow, that's a big question. You know,
It was shot beautifully. It had a wonderful point of view. And of course, he was the center of it. But what do you think made it so special?
I think you've got it right there. You know, he was a tremendous cinephile. He loved film. And I think when you watch the shows, even if you don't know that, you can tell, as you say, that they're beautifully filmed. But if you know that he's referencing specific movies, specific directors, aesthetic periods, there's a whole visual element that helps inform it. But I think also his perspective, again, on the world, which became kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. He had a number of TV shows that sent him all over the world, and by the time he was filming Parts Unknown, he'd gone through a cook's tour, he'd done No Reservations, and he was able to approach that show not as someone who was seeing the world for the first time, but as someone who had been already to many of the places that he was filming at. And I think that level of familiarity also creates a degree of intimacy. And he and his extraordinary production crew had an amazing ability to convey intimacy and excitement and exhilaration and weirdness and discomfort and pleasure in a television medium that we really rarely see it in.
What's interesting is, again, that connects to his openness and just his kind of openness of spirit. And yet there were dark parts of his life that he didn't really talk about, his struggles with mental health. Were you surprised by how things turned out for him?
I certainly was. I can't imagine that anybody saw his death coming the way that it did.
He was so candid about so many other things, but he didn't really speak about depression and issues like that, did he?
Not that often. There were a couple of episodes of the show, and I'm thinking in particular of an episode, I think it took place in Buenos Aires, where he had a conceit where he was sort of lying on a therapist's couch, like he was in a Freudian analysis, and he's talking to the camera as therapist, basically. And he mentions, and I don't think that this was fake, right? I don't think this was a put on for the camera. He talks about the fact that sometimes he'll be in the middle of taking a bite of a hamburger or sitting on an airplane or being in an airport, and he's got the best life in the world and this daughter that he loves and this family around him that's amazing and success beyond his wildest dreams. And suddenly the black cloud just plummets over his head.
He said that.
And he wasn't tremendous sort of explicit outspoken advocate for mental health, but I think it is present in everything that he did. You know, he wrote about struggles with substance abuse. Mm-hmm. He wrote about struggles with low self-esteem, with feelings of imposter syndrome, with the physical toll that physical labor takes on your body. Mm-hmm. I mean, all sorts of things that are part of the package of mental health. And he talked about them in a way that said, like, this is an experience, right? This isn't a judgment. It's a thing. And if you're not happy, unhappiness is part of it. You don't have to pretend to be happy. You don't have to pretend to like what you're doing. And he really, I don't know, you know, the fact that he died by suicide hit me like a truck, you know? And I think it was that for so many people who were close to him, people who felt like they were close to him, the millions of people who thought of him as a friend. It came out of nowhere, and it's still a real devastation.
I can only imagine. What do you miss most about your friend, your good acquaintance, your colleague?
I mean, you know, I mentioned this in my intro to the book that shortly before he died, he had sent me an email with just an empty, fluffy piece of gossip about someone that. Well, someone who maybe deserved to be emptily and fluffily gossiped about, and I hadn't replied, and he sent me another email. He double emailed me, and he was like, "Hey, like, you know, acknowledge my snarky joke.
I
like, tell
know
me
that
this
you
is
got
funny."
This.
And I was putting off replying to it, and then
he died.
And you know, this is like, it's an ungoawayable notification. You know, it's an unanswerable question, and I think that the joy that I took in my friendship with him was really these very little things. You know, we had occasional big sweeping conversations about the state of media, the state of the world, but he was a person. And I think that's part of why he was such a beloved celebrity. You could tell that if you sat around with him, you could just, like, you know, chew the fat. You could just talk about stuff, make jokes. And he was funny and real and raw. And that's such a valuable thing in a friend, whether the friendship is one-sided with a celebrity or two-sided with a real person.
That really did come across with him. He did seem completely authentic. I've been speaking with New Yorker staff writer Helen Rosner. Thank you so much for joining us on All of It today and sharing your memories. Her book, Anthony Bourdain, The Last Interview and Other Conversations, she does the introduction, and they're wonderful final interviews with him. Thank you.
Thank you so much.